Welcome to CoreCast, a production of National Community Renaissance, a nonprofit affordable housing developer dedicated to solving the housing challenges facing seniors, veterans, and low-income families in America. CoreCast is a monthly podcast designed to expand interest in the area of affordable housing, as well as explore solutions and interview problem solvers in the industry. Welcome in to episode 4 of CoreCast. Glad to have you back listening with us again. This is Jonathan Kendrick, joined as always by our co-host Steve Pontell, the president and CEO of National Community Renaissance. Steve, how are you doing today?
Doing well, thank you very much.
And Steve, our guest today is Greg Devereaux, the CEO of San Bernardino County, who will be joining us a little bit later to discuss, among other things, the most critical issues facing San Bernardino County, as well as the cost of not housing our population. So we'll look forward to that discussion a little bit later. We'll also discuss with Greg this county's push towards ending homelessness for veterans in the county. And this is an issue that has been a focus nationally, and one where that we're going to discuss in our water cooler segment, as we do in every CoreCast episode. We begin with a discussion on the issues that are in the news and how they relate to affordable housing. And so this homeless veterans initiative that has been laid out at a national level, there was a mayor's challenge, the first lady, the White House has been in on this, and there's been actually a longer-term goal from back in 2010. The VA and others set the goal of ending veteran homelessness by the end of 2015. And as we're getting down to it, there has been great progress in this area. In 2009, there were estimated 74,000 homeless veterans in the United States. That number is now below 50,000. And it's interesting, this week in the news, Mayor Eric Garcetti of Los Angeles came out and said that the city of Los Angeles is not going to be able to house all of its homeless veterans by the end of the year. But he said it's a little bit different for Los Angeles for other areas. The city of LA still has, or the county still has, more than 4,000 homeless veterans. And in all, it's about 9% of the nation's challenge. So it's not one that is spread out equally across the nation, and one that LA is dealing with acutely and especially at this time. But as we talk with Steve today, what are some of the issues that kind of surround veterans homelessness? It's an issue that, in our industry has a lot of emphasis and a lot of attention right now. And there's a lot of political push behind it and a lot of energy around this issue and around ending veteran homelessness. And what kind of progress have you seen people coming together around this?
Well, it's a great question. Thank you, Jonathan. Good to be with you again. I think it's important to think about homelessness broadly defined as an intro to the conversation, as opposed to merely veterans homelessness, which is a critical issue and currently is providing a lot of necessary energy to dealing with. But the challenges around homelessness are not new, and it's something that I think we as a society need to be very honest about. What is it we're willing to do, and what is it that we're willing to accept? But a couple of principles that I think we should think about is, the costs of the homeless population far exceed the cost of providing housing for the homeless population. And so we just boil it down to the basic math. It's kind of silly the way we don't respond to the needs of the homeless population. And I think LA County is a great example, as they've done an excellent job of, within their public health department, launching a housing initiative focusing on creating housing for the homeless population. And there's a couple of connections. One is, just think about being homeless is not a very healthy lifestyle. And so the homeless population uses healthcare at the highest price point, only using emergency rooms. And once you've had a medical procedure, the best place to recover is not back out on the streets. And so the recidivism rate of the homeless population going back into the emergency rooms is very high. And so what LA County's public health department has experienced, and their statistics show, is a 77% drop in emergency room usage among housed homeless population and an 84% drop in the return visits by the homeless. And so when you think about veterans, you know, we as a society should have a conscious responsibility in meeting their needs because they've served, you know, on behalf of all of us. But at the same time, it's the right thing to do from an economic and a agency perspective, that if we want to really address the needs of our community and do it in a cost-effective fashion, providing appropriate housing for the homeless population is a very important step in that direction.
Now, the National Housing Conference and their Center for Housing Policy puts out excellent documents, research-based, evidence-based documents, and they've come out with one this summer called Housing and Services Needs of Our Changing Veteran Population, Serving Our Older Veterans, Female Veterans, and Post-9/11 Veterans. And they kind of boil it down to three aspects of this, what they call service-enriched housing. There's the physical building, and there's the rent subsidies, which in many cases come through a program that the Office of Housing and Urban Development does called HUD-VASH, these vouchers that allow the veterans to pay with a subsidy. And then the third part of that is the supportive services that go around being housed and the case management. So, Steve, what does it kind of entail to end this problem? It's not just providing a bed. What is, you know, as someone, the National Corps has had many of these conversations around housing veterans, and it takes a lot for a, you know, apartment owner, a landlord to get their minds around this.
Sure. Well, I think it's an important point to realize that it's not one size fits all. There are certain portions of the population that have different needs. And at one end of the spectrum are the people that need permanent supportive housing, as it's called, which would be a permanent housing subsidy coupled with necessary services, counseling, support in order for them to be able to have as healthy a life as they can have. And I think one of the challenges is we often look at the population monolithically, and in reality, there are people that need permanent support. There are people in transitional periods where they're just having a tough time and they need to stabilize so they can move on. There are single veterans, there are families. And so thinking there are different solutions for each of those populations as we go forward. And ultimately, the underlying challenge for all of this is we have such a dramatic shortage of supply. And unfortunately, the resources for the production of new housing units are very slim and getting slimmer. And so I think that's in the long run, there are rent subsidies that people can take to existing landlords and existing facilities, but the actual resources for the production of new housing are very limited. And that's something I think we need to take a very hard look at.
Yeah, and that leads us into our second area of discussion today, and that supply of housing. You know, as we look into housing homeless veterans, that one of those pillars that's needed is just a supply of housing. You know, there may be subsidy available, there may be the case management, but is there enough supply of housing? And a report was released this week just looking at Los Angeles County, and it says, you know, among other things, the key findings that 26.1% of people in Los Angeles County live in poverty, and that's largely due to high housing costs. Overcrowding for low-income renters in LA County, three times greater than the national average. There's been reductions in federal and state funds, including the elimination of redevelopment funding over the last several years. It's been a 65% reduction in the last 7 years, $466 million less now for affordable housing than it was then. And so this problem, you know, continues to pop up. It seems in every one of these podcasts we mention another study where it says, you know, there's not enough housing. People are being increasingly driven into poverty by housing costs. Inflation adjusted median rents in LA County over the last 13 years has increased by 27%, while the household income has declined by 7%. So, Steve, the question to you is, when does this steady drumbeat of report after report, meeting after meeting, become something that rises up to where someone will take notice? Who needs to take notice to make this an issue that can be tackled?
Right. Great question, and a difficult one, because the political constituency that is unhoused is not a very powerful constituency. And so I've not met anybody that denies the need, but there are powerful forces that are against the production of additional housing. And they come from all sorts of different perspectives. You know, there's plenty of NIMBYism, you know, the not in my backyard syndrome. Then there are the bananas, build absolutely nothing anywhere, that would prefer people leaving as opposed to providing the necessary housing for them. And so there are very powerful political constituencies that are against the production of additional housing units, and we have to take that into consideration. You know, when we know that we've been doing the same thing for the last 50 years and the hole is just getting deeper and deeper, to continue doing it would be the definition of not being very bright. And so at the end of the day, my hope would be community leaders would lead and understand the long-term consequences of not having an adequate supply of housing is the ultimate deterioration of all of our neighborhoods. Because the overcrowding that you referenced before means multiple families living together, which means worse educational performance by the children, higher demands for social interventions, higher social stresses on the families living in overcrowded conditions, and a wearing out of neighborhood infrastructure. If you design the neighborhood for population X and you put 2X in the neighborhood, the roads, water, schools, police, fire, parks all deteriorate faster than they were designed for. And so until our community leaders can really see and understand the consequences of not having an adequate supply and the cost of not having an adequate supply of housing, and so then they do the smart thing, which also happens to be the right thing, and begin to fight for the production of more housing, I think we have a real challenge.
And this leads to my next question that, you know, as we look at local leaders, at regional leaders, you know, the issue that's really, or the topic, I guess, that's getting a lot of play and taking up a lot of ink in newspapers and online and in TV news broadcasts is the presidential election, and rightfully so. But the issues that we hear brought up over and over again, a lot of them are in the foreign policy arena. You know, what to do with China, the proposed nuclear accord with Iran, ISIS in the Middle East. And on the domestic side, the issues, you know, are around immigration, economy, and the jobs and healthcare. But there really hasn't been any talk in this election or in elections past on housing. And so, Steve, if there was a question that you could ask to the presidential candidates on either side, what would that be? Would it be a different question on either side, or would it be one question? And what would you want to know from them?
Sure. I mean, I actually do think it would probably be two different questions. So on the Republican side, I think it would have to be a question, given the distortions that occur that prevent the market from producing an adequate supply of housing for the population we have, what could we do to eliminate some of those distortions? How do we begin to move the ball so that the marketplace can begin to produce housing at a price point that people can afford, and engage them in a real conversation so that they can understand why it is that the market is not working in the area of housing? And on the Democratic side of the equation, I would ask, how do you balance the current dominant environmental agenda, which is against development and against the production of units, with the social justice agenda, which is promoting meeting the needs of families in those very basic food, shelter categories? And so I think you need to get both halves of the equation engaged in a conversation around their own agendas and their own philosophies in order to be able to have a complete conversation that can hopefully lead to the production of additional housing units.
And is this a conversation that you see as feasible? Is there, you know, a way to inject this into the discussion, the national discussion at this point as we lead up to the election?
Yeah, Ron Terwilliger and the Terwilliger Institute is pushing very hard to have questions added into the debates and pose questions to the candidates during the initial phases of the campaign about housing. And so we've been in contact with them and are helping to provide some additional information. So hopefully those questions will get answers. And if we can get them answering on the record, then we can begin to build a dialogue around this critical issue.
All right. And with that, we will transition into the interview portion of our segment. And we look forward to having Greg Devereaux with us, the CEO of San Bernardino County. Thank you.
Mr. Devereaux, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
Good. Looking forward to this conversation. The broad conversation today is as it affects housing. But before we get into that, you know, you've now been at the county for
5.5 years.
And so I think it would be illustrative to people if you just share a little bit about, you know, some of the differences between being at cities as you were for so long versus counties. And then we'll probably tie that back into this issue of those two levels of government and housing and how the pieces fit together. But what were the two or three major surprises that you experienced coming to the county?
I think the first one is that cities and counties are truly different forms of government. Oddly enough, in cities, we view counties as big cities, and we pretty much think that they do what we do in cities and that they legally are structured the same way. And that's not true at all. Cities are independent corporations, and they have all of the corporate powers in regard to municipal affairs that the state hasn't taken away. Counties are arms of the state, extensions of the state, and they are not corporations. They only have the corporate powers that the legislature has given. And just as the legislature hasn't taken many away from cities, they haven't given very many to counties. The other huge difference is that structurally, cities in California are primarily what's known as council manager form of government. So you have the elected city council, mayor, maybe a couple of minor other elected officials like a treasurer, a clerk, and the council, like a board of directors of a corporation, appoints a city manager to run everything, whatever policies they or programs they come up with to implement those. The whole rest of the organization, the police chief, fire chief, public works director, parks director, reports to the city managers, hired by the city manager. That's a very clean organizational structure. So if the council becomes concerned because the car thefts have gone up, they call the city manager, say, hey, car thefts have gone up. What are you going to do about it? He or she gets on the phone to the police chief, who he's hired, his raises due to whatever the city action the city manager takes, can fire the police chief, and the city manager says, council's concerned about auto thefts. By that evening or the next morning, there are police officers working auto thefts. Counties not only have separate districts, which not all cities do, but also separately elected officials. Sheriff, DA, assessor are all state constitutional officers. They are separately elected. They don't report to the board. They don't report to the CEO of the county. They report to the people. So they operate independently. That's a significant difference. So unless you have something to tie them together, they're going to do whatever they believe is right for that function instead of working toward any kind of common goal.
Well, then that's a great lead-in to the conversation about housing. Because for cities, then housing would be viewed as one element of the implementation of the general plan and a real estate development play. Whereas at the county, the consequences of housing or not housing are felt across numerous departments, whether it's mental health or other social services and health care and et cetera.
And that's exactly right. And that's the last major difference is that we all know pretty much what cities do. Police, fire, parks, streets, trash maybe. Counties have four lines of business. The biggest and most important line is the social safety net. Then it's law and justice, then there are cross-cutting services, and the last thing is city-like or municipal services in the unincorporated areas.
So then the cost and consequences of not having an adequate supply of housing falls more on the county because it's the going to have to provide services to the population that's not adequately housed. Mm-hmm. And cities don't feel the cost of that.
Not in the same way. You're right. Absolutely right. So the services to those people that are not adequately housed or underemployed or unemployed falls much more on the county. County does have the social safety net services.
So then an issue like veterans homelessness, which is, you know, currently nationwide getting a lot of attention, a lot of energy. The county's been leading a conversation, an initiative to deal with it within San Bernardino County. How have you been able to bring the right people to the table, and how is progress being made?
Well, it's interesting because there has been a working group for a while, even before the county, parts of the county were engaged, but not at the board level and not at the CEO level, the administration itself. So in much the same way we were just talking about in terms of their functional responsibility, some of them were engaged with a working group that was trying to achieve the national goal of ending homelessness for veterans this year, by the end of the calendar year. We brought in a national expert, Philip Mangano, who I know you know. He headed the Interagency Council on Homelessness for the Bush administration and into the Obama administration, nationally known figure. And Philip helped us understand that if that kind of goal was going to be achieved in the county, it really needed to be elevated and needed the full support of the administration, needed the full support of the Board of Supervisors. We took the issue before them. They committed to that work. And what we added to that working group that was already meeting every week was a different level of advisors and leadership to help them. So that group meets or talks on the phone every single week to talk through. We know who those homeless vets are. There's actually a list of the 401 homeless veterans within the county. And that group had been working, and we formed this other group to get the right people in the room. We had the first meeting of that group several weeks ago, and that group will meet monthly to hear from the weekly working group a report on how many veterans have been housed, how many are yet to be housed, and most importantly, what are the impediments that they're facing that the working group at their level cannot solve or break through, or what resources do they need to house more veterans. And in that very first meeting, it showed that we probably have enough resource, but everyone didn't know how to tap those resources. So the people in that room were able to say, well, if that's the problem, I can bring emergency shelter grant funding, for instance, to providing deposits that right now veterans can't don't have, or that nobody had money for in the system. They have something called housing navigators that work with the veterans and go out to the property owners, help them fill out the application, help them go through the interview, help them get established in a unit. Well, right now, the nonprofits and the other groups that were working to help house veterans only had two housing navigators. Well, they really needed more housing navigators than that. We were able to identify not only the funding, but given the time frame within which we're trying to do this, you needed experienced people. You didn't have time to train new people to do it. Well, Dan Nackerman, the executive director of the Housing Authority, was able to say, well, we've got a pool of 9 navigators. We could free up a couple of them to work on this effort.
Sure. And so the other opportunity, and I'm curious, it seems as though LA County has done a very good job within their public health department creating a housing authority with a focus on providing housing for 10,000 homeless, the most seriously ill of the homeless population. And what they're able to do, because their public health department and their all of their healthcare infrastructure is under one umbrella organization at LA County, the savings that are accruing by cutting the costs of delivering healthcare to the homeless population are benefiting that single agency. And this, what they found so far is that a housed homeless person, the emergency room visits are reduced by 77%, and the recidivism is reduced by 84%. Within San Bernardino County, do you see that kind of an opportunity existing as well to be able to realize the savings in one department, even though that department's job would traditionally not be to focus on housing?
I think the opportunity is there. I don't think we have it figured out yet. For quite a while, I've been focusing on how do you use downstream savings from an upstream action? How do you fund the upstream action? I think we're getting closer. Interestingly enough, I think where we're getting closer is through IEHP, our Medi-Cal provider. I think that they are willing to be innovative and look at ways of moving that money to those upstream interventions. Part of the problem, and you and I have discussed this on other occasions, is that so many of the federal programs are structured in a way that doesn't allow that. And let's take something like food stamps, for instance. If you were able to take that money that goes into food stamps, if there was an upstream action that prevented that person or kept that person from needing those food stamps, you couldn't fund it with that stream of funding. You could only issue more food stamps to someone else. So breaking that cycle and freeing up those monies, I'm fascinated, and I will be making some calls to find out more about it, because I think that's one of the biggest impediments is not being able to move that money.
Sure. So maybe to take a step at the broader challenge, you know, one of the things that I think is becoming increasingly obvious is, and I think you've articulated this well, every city has zoned significant quantities of retail beyond that which they will ever imagine need. And we know we're overbuilt in the retail sector. So on the one side, we have a shortage of housing, and on the other side, we have a surplus of retail. How do we begin to have a conversation so that other aspects of local government, cities, unincorporated areas can come to a realistic understanding of both the retail opportunity and the housing need? How do we move that bar?
Well, one of the things we're doing a general plan update, and we're doing something very different with it. And I won't go into the whole structure of it, but one of the parts of that general plan that we want to create is a regional forum that is really a database or a repository of information like that. If cities don't look at other cities' general plans when they're doing their general plan. So I can guarantee you in the high desert, for instance, that almost every city, if not every city in the high desert, has more zoning for distribution and warehouse and industrial manufacturing than will probably exist in the entirety of the high desert. The same is true in the valley with retail, as you appropriately point out. Because we don't look at the regional demand and we only look at ours, there are cities that have assumed essentially that they will get all, if not more than, all of the retail demand that exists. One of the things that we have talked about over the years that I don't think gets enough focus is that if the wages of the jobs you're providing don't allow the people who are employed in those areas to find affordable housing that is affordable to them. They will find a way to house themselves in ways that create impacts to the community that the community doesn't want. Whether that's sleeping in a trailer in a backyard or sleeping in a garage or overcrowding the unit, they're going to find of necessity a way to house themselves. Well, if that's true and the community doesn't want those impacts, then the community would benefit from figuring out ways to create more affordable housing. Now, we all know that the revenues that have historically supported affordable housing in California have been under attack, and housing set aside, redevelopment housing set aside, one of the biggest sources for the last several decades of affordable housing funding in this state has now gone away. With that, we have to get more creative. One of the things that just happened within the last few months is there was a decision on inclusionary zoning that said, no, it is legal. It is allowed. As you know, we took an inclusionary zoning approach in Ontario when I was city manager there when we were developing the Ag Preserve. We said, you, developer, can either include this percentage of affordable housing in your development, or you can develop this much more outside of your development because it might economically work, or you can deposit into a fund that the city can use to create more affordable housing. And the courts have recently found that kind of approach is legal.
So we only have about a minute left, but what admonition or encouragement could you give local government leaders to think about using housing as part of their economic development strategy?
Well, I have always found housing to be a key part of an economic development strategy, because if you can figure out the equation of how to fund affordable housing, that housing provides the people you need to support the retail you want. So if you look at the housing in downtown Fontana right now, that is part of that started when I was city manager there. My housing director and I, there was no question that they wanted to revitalize downtown. We did the same thing in Ontario. We sometimes are our own biggest enemy, though. Those were the right places for higher density, for affordable housing, and that affordable housing and that density were the solution to a community problem that the community hadn't been able to solve. Putting that housing in the right places in the community, everybody talks about NIMBYism. I have never found NIMBYism to be a problem if you were putting the housing in the right places in the community.
Great point. Last question. Will the veterans be housed in San Mateo County by the end of the year?
Absolutely.
Great. Thank you for being here, Greg.
Thanks much.
And we want to again thank our guest from today, CEO Greg Devereaux of the County of San Bernardino. We enjoyed having him on. And Steve, something that I had picked up from this interview was just the focus that this county has, first through its vision statement that lays out what the goal is and taking steps toward moving to accomplish that. And really what it springs from is having the information first, and this idea of a community indicators report. What are the things going on in a community? What are the stats? What are the numbers that show us what's happening? So then the decision makers have that information to move forward. And I know this is something that's been you've been passionate about for a long time, something you've been instrumental in the development of. And it's not only in San Bernardino County, but Riverside County and Orange County. And we were down in Orange County just this week for a forum to discuss the Orange County Community Indicators Report. And one of the findings from that was the areas that are most in need of attention there. One of them is the affordability of housing, education, and the skills gap between the workforce and what employers are looking for. And so, Steve, how have you seen the community indicators having that information for community leaders to have be really essential for making informed, good decisions that move a community forward?
Thank you, Jonathan. You know, the challenge we have is really on two halves of the equation. One, most communities do not have a clear vision of where they want to go. And so that's an important component that San Mateo County, under Mr. Devereaux's leadership, has really, you know, defined and refined priorities and vision for the future of San Mateo County. But then along those lines, how are you measuring progress? You know, how do you know what direction you're going? And one of the challenges we have is the information resides in silos where the walls are tall and thick, and information sharing between the silos happens very rarely. What the Community Indicators Report does is allow information from each of the major categories of issues in the counties to be consolidated so people can look at it in more of a systemic or holistic fashion. So you'll have, you know, education people look at education statistics all day long, and water people look at water statistics, and transportation and economic and housing. To put all those together, you can then begin to see a pattern, and you can really identify trends that then should be triggering important conversations. And so, as you said, we were just at the release of the Orange County Community Indicators Report yesterday, and the Orange County Community Indicators Report shows some very interesting and disturbing trends. One, Orange County is aging very rapidly, and it's a great place to retire. You know, from Orange County, are you going to move to Florida to retire? Probably not. And so that aging in place of the senior population consumes a lot of the housing supply. Producing additional new housing in Orange County is very difficult. And so Orange County is losing a lot of their young, upwardly mobile executives. And employers in Orange County are having a very difficult time attracting and retaining the talent they need because they can't afford to live in Orange County. And so if you play that forward over the long haul, Orange County is going to become a very nice retirement community if they don't solve for the housing that they need for their workforce. And then on the other end of the spectrum, what the report showed, 29,000 children in the K-12 skills are living either double or tripled up, families in a single unit. And so once again, the consequences of overcrowding, poor educational performance, more challenging social issues. And so at the end of the day, that should be a stark reminder to the leaders of Orange County how important it is to produce additional housing units for the people that can least afford it, because these are people that are working in the hotels and the resorts and the construction industries and, you know, all throughout Orange County, all levels of the workforce are important. And the Community Indicators Report does a good job showing that complete picture. San Mateo County's Community Indicators Report should be coming out in October, and it'll be another great way to touch base and see, you know, what's trending, what are the challenges facing the county.
As we like to do to finish each of our episodes here on CoreCast, is the one thing you learned this week. And so for me, first, it was really the idea of the progress that can be made on an issue when there is a focus of resources and an attention. I think as we've seen that in the issue with veterans homelessness, and just the fact that people across the nation have banded together, have committed to this, and have set a goal, a deadline. You know, in San Bernardino County's case, it's by the end of 2015. And then the amount of progress that they've been able to make just each week has been really astounding. So for me, that was, you know, an interesting thing to learn. Just when we do put something together, the power of a community working together. Steve, what is it for you from this week, your one thing you learned?
Well, and I'll just add on to that. The having the leadership in the region behind it. So with the Board of Supervisors leading the initiative, with Greg backing it and pushing it so that all of the various agencies and departments come together and give focus to the issue is a critical part of building that partnership and that coalition to accomplish the goal. And so we do need our leaders to step up and lead in order to solve many of these challenging problems.
Well, thank you, Steve, for your time today, and we do thank you for listening as well. This has been the fourth episode of CoreCast, a production of National Community Renaissance. If you want to find out more information about our organization, you can log on to www.nationalcore.org, and we'd love to hear from you. Please send your questions, your comments to me. You can email me at jkendrick@nationalcore.org, and we'd love to incorporate your feedback into the show. Well, that'll do it for this episode. We look forward to talking with you again next time.